right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show, and I'm always like just set on fire with decisions from Outer National. I'm really glad we got that going up there now. Like I said, we have a packed show, man. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Will Francom, co-director of a film called The Penalty, a new documentary that takes on the horror of the death penalty in the U.S. through the stories of three different people impacted by them in different ways, by the death penalty in different ways. Before that, we'll be hearing of something that actually a lot of people commented on, and they really wanted to hear again, and that was a piece of music that was that we played a few weeks ago, and it's called All Played Out, and it's by Bob Avakian and William Parker, jazz musician William Parker. So I'm really looking forward to playing that again. Before that, we will be talking with Alan Mills, executive director of Uptown People's Law Center, on their lawsuit opposing Illinois prison's censorship of Blood in the Water, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book by historian Heather Ann Thompson, and the 1971 Attica Prison Uprising. And I'm telling you, folks, this is an extremely important piece to pay attention to here. I read the article that Alan wrote, and he was very, very sharp on that. And I thought it was important for people to dig into this. So without any further ado, I'm going to welcome Alan to the show. Alan, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Sure. Let's jump into it because I got about 30 questions for you.
Okay.
No, it's only nine. There you go. Two Illinois prisons have censored Heather Thompson's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Blood in the Water. Now, our listeners are actually familiar with the book, familiar with Heather. She's been on the show. We've had her on when the book first came out. She's been on the show a couple other times, and we look forward to having her on again soon. But I wanted people to understand that in this world we live in today, when you do something like what Heather did with that book, that it's not just, you don't just turn around, get all the accolades, and walk away. There's something else that's happening, and we see what's happening here. Why is it happening?
Well, I think that, in fact, Heather's book sort of answers that question. One of the themes that runs throughout Heather's book, and in part why I think she wrote it, is that who controls the message has vast consequences. One of the arguments she makes is that our entire structure of mass incarceration is really based on the lies that were told around Attica and several other events that happened at the same time, that the state was able to control that message and was able to convey to the public that the problem in Attica was not violent state repression, the problem in Attica was not horrific prison conditions. The problem at Attica, according to the state, was we had these horrible animals locked up who were willing to sacrifice innocent guards, who were willing to slit their throats, who were willing to emasculate them just to get more peanut butter. That's sort of the way the state portrayed what happened at Attica. We now know all of that was a lie. But nonetheless, that idea that there are people who just are different than us and are somehow wild animals who need to be caged is the narrative that won the day. And as a result, then we had all these tough-on-crime initiatives. We had truth in sentencing. We had getting rid of parole. We had day-for-day good time taken out, mandatory minimums, the war on drugs. All that happened after Attica, and all of it was really based in large part on the narrative that came out of Attica, as well as things like Wounded Knee. The 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago is another key example, which was a police riot, but at the time was put across to the public as being these out-of-town radicals who came in to cause trouble. So who controls the messaging matters. And the state took that to heart, and they want to control the messaging not only coming out of prisons, as we saw in the recent national prison strike, but the message of what goes into prisons. And that, I think, is why the censorship of communications going both ways to and from prisoners is such a vital issue. The world is not going to know what happens inside prisons without prisoners being able to speak for themselves, and prisoners are going to have no idea that they have support on the outside without free communication.
Let's go step back a little bit more, though, because one of the things that really got me is that when you
packed a lot in there, sorry.
No, that's fine, man. That's fine. I like that actually. But you know, one of the things when I first set out to read this piece that you wrote on it in Truth Out, I was looking at it and I thought you have you begin something with it saying two Illinois prisons have censored Blood in the Water, the Pulitzer Prize winning book by historian Heather Ann Thompson about the 1971 Attica uprising. And you talk about on September 13th, Chicago-based Uptown People's Law Center, which is where you work, filed a lawsuit to challenge this unconstitutional and unethical censorship. And I wanted to actually jump into this because it you know, it's kind of stunning that there hasn't been a bigger uproar around this, but there's actually a lot of confusion, I think, because one of the things that people are saying, or that the system is saying, what the system seems to be saying is that, look, there's no room for challenging what we say, you know, and they put out this thing that's like a little bit arbitrary, you know, it's a hopscotch kind of approach, banned here, not there, one person gets banned, another person doesn't. What's going on here? Because it is, a lot of it is really covering the ass of the authorities in a big way, sadistic treatment, but covering the ass of the authorities.
Well, right, I mean, I think it's always true that those who oppress other people would prefer that the people that they're oppressing not understand what's happening to them. And that is particularly true in prison. There's been huge crackdowns on everything from literature coming in, but also just to prisoners politically educating themselves as to what's going on. There used to be active study groups inside many prisons where they could study works from the outside and try to figure out how they applied to their lives and all that. Prison officials have taken a hard stance at trying to stop that. So I think that there is definitely a concerted effort to stop that kind of communication from happening. But like anything, prisons are big bureaucracies. Bureaucracies are manned by individual people. And an awful lot of this censorship happens based on what the person who happens to open the mail thinks. So if they think that this particular sort of communication is offensive or dangerous, then they turn around and write up a little slip and send it back and say, no, this can't come in. Some other random person reading this material might say, well, I'll let it in. So that's also part of the problem, is the total arbitrariness of what happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, you argue, too, that the community, just to make it clear to people, that this is not sort of a, oh, well, you know, come on, these guys are complaining because these people are complaining because they're not getting their letters, they're not getting this, they're not getting that. But you make the point that these communications with prisoners is vitally important for a number of reasons. Let's dig into that for people that don't know why these are so important.
Yeah, and let me start by making clear who the plaintiff is here. The people complaining in this case, I mean, the prisoner did complain, but the person who's the plaintiff in this case, the one bringing the case, is the author, Professor Thompson. So she herself thinks it's really important that prisoners understand what prisons are all about. And she has said that that's one of the reasons she wrote the book, is to expose not just to the world, but to current prisoners. So she, I think you start off by saying you don't just write a book like this and go away. It's a continuing fight, and one that she's taken to heart. She's taken to heart the obligation to act as the spokesperson for people on the inside, to act to magnify the voice of the people inside now that she has this stage because she's written this really powerful book.
Mm-hmm. So it actually is. It's a vital thing that's happening for people both on the inside and the outside in this. Because, I mean, it is sort of without that. You think about it, without that kind of thing that you're talking about Heather doing, and, you know, and everybody else who's concerned with this, you do end up with a very hellish kind of situation that can actually be a matter of life and death for the prisoners.
Absolutely. And, I mean, prison itself is always isolating. I mean, obviously, you're isolated from the community. That's the whole point of prison. But without communications, it gets even worse. So the very specific example that I use a lot is I was talking to a woman inside the female prison, Logan, which is one of the ones that censored the book here in Illinois, shortly before she got out, and she was really upset. She's like, you know, how come nobody on the outside cares about this? Where's the feminist movement? How come there's no action on the outside? And I said, well, it does exist. And she's like, no, it doesn't. And then she got, and, you know, she didn't really believe what I was saying. And then she got out a few months later and has become really active. And she's like, nobody inside knows what's going on here. There are hundreds of people that actually care about this, but the word doesn't get inside. And that's why this sort of censorship is so important, because without knowing that there's people on the outside who are supporting them, people on the inside are willing to give up because they think that they're all alone in this fight, where they're not. There are actually thousands of people who care about the way prisons are operating and are actively taking steps to resist the current system. But that word isn't getting in, so therefore there's a real feeling of hopelessness inside.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alan Mills, who's from the Uptown People's Law Center, and it's a nonprofit legal services organization specializing in prisoners' rights, social security, disability, and tenants' rights, and eviction defense. And it's actually in Chicago, and we're talking about, look, two Illinois prisons have censored Heather Ann Thompson's book, Blood in the Water, the Pulitzer Prize winning book, and they've censored it. And it's a book about, as we've been saying, about the Attica uprising, the 1971 Attica prison uprising. And on September 13th, the Chicago-based Uptown Law, People's Law Center filed a lawsuit to challenge this unconstitutional and unethical censorship, which is why we're talking today, right now. And it's really important right now. One of the things I wanted to ask you as well is the censorship policies that exist in prison, because, you know, for some things, like even if you start reading this and you say, okay, well, two people got the book over here, one person didn't get the book here, another person didn't get it there, and it kind of leads to people thinking, well, there's not really an actual censorship policy that's going on in the prison. But you argue that this is actually part of that, that the censorship policies are unconstitutionally broad and basically come down to denying First Amendment limits on censorship.
That's right. And we did not just file the case. We went to the Department of Corrections and said, all right, this happened. It seems to be random. Are you willing to just say the book gets in everywhere? And after we actually had to buy them a copy of the book because they had never read it, but we bought them a copy of the book, and after they read it, they said, no, we're not allowing this in. We're sticking with the policy that it doesn't come in. So this is not just it may have started with somebody random picking it out and saying no, but ultimately the highest levels of the department decided that this was the policy they're going to adopt. And it was only after that we filed a lawsuit. I mean, our interest was getting the book in, not bringing a lawsuit. So if they had said, yeah, somebody made a mistake, we're going to let it in, then we wouldn't have ever gone to court. But instead, they doubled down on it and said, we don't know how this happened in the first place, but we think the policy is nobody gets to read this book in the Department of Corrections.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does this fall out in relation to, for instance, this is a big question for a lot of people. I mean, for one thing, a lot of the press that, you know, might have access to the prisoners, I always feel like I can't necessarily trust all of them, and I think for good reason. And, you know, but because you see people who have actually, you know, distorted stories and all these other things.
Sure.
But there's another section of the press that actually does work hard to go in and actually know what's happening inside the prisons and during actions that are taken as well as in normal times. Like this most recent action that occurred all over the country among the prisoners, the strike and stuff that was going on, it was just horribly undercovered in most of the major press. And this is a very bad thing for not just the prisoners, but all of us.
No, I agree. I agree. And I think that's why open communication between the people in the outside world and prisoners is so vital. If prison officials are allowed to select which reporters go in and which reporters get access to people, then it's going to be a very slanted sort of reporting as to what's going on. It's going to be very limited. It's going to have a particular point of view. And that's exactly what the First Amendment is intended to prevent. It's intended to prevent government officials from picking and choosing which voices are allowed to be heard. And that's exactly what's happening in prison. So everybody, all press should have the right to do telephone interviews, to go into a visiting room and visit with a prisoner who's willing to visit with them. It doesn't mean that they have to be given free rein to wander around the prison. Nobody's asking for that. But, for example, in Illinois, reporters are allowed to come in if they are on a personal visiting list with a prisoner, but they're not allowed to bring pencils and papers, let alone cameras and computers and all that nifty stuff. So reporting is extraordinarily limited and totally at the discretion of the Department of Corrections. So that means if the department doesn't want something covered, it doesn't get covered. And there's a perfect example right now. There have been a couple of very vague press reports showing that within a three-day period, three people died in Menard Correctional Center, one of our maximum security prisons down in the southern tip of Illinois. And there's no information being released about how the deaths occurred, what they died of. None of that's being released. So where does that leave the public? The public is totally at ignorant as to what's going on. There's no way to find out what's going on. And think of a mom whose son is in prison. Is there something going on that they should worry about? Is there a mass problem down there? Has there been some, you know, mass? Are there murders going on down there? Is it a poisoning going on down there? One of the rumors is it's a heat stroke. That there's a real problem with heat stroke. None of the cells are air conditioned. People don't know. And there's no reason in the world that shouldn't be publicly available, knowing why are people dying inside prison. So, as you said before, this can have real consequences for people inside, this sort of closed inability to communicate.
Mm-hmm. You know, I keep thinking about that, actually, just off of that, I keep thinking about how important it is for people to be able to communicate, but also this question of how important it is for the press to actually know what's happening inside these prisons, because, you know, and in particular, the honest press, but the press that actually cares about what's happening among the people. And, you know, under, I think you pointed this out, that under mass incarceration, you know, that anybody who wants to understand mass incarceration actually needs to understand Attica. And if you want to understand Attica, you can't do that without reading Heather's book, which I think I really agree with. I think it's really an important book for people who want to understand Attica, but also what developed after Attica and what's going on now.
As I said in my piece, I have been litigating prisoner rights cases since the early 1980s, and I thought I understood mass incarceration and what it was all about, and then I read Heather's book, and I'm like, okay, this gives me a different perspective on it. This idea of controlling the narrative and how carefully it was constructed just was not something I had thought about. So I thank her very much for opening my eyes, and I'm certainly more aware of what's going on in prisons than the average person is. And don't forget, even if you don't have somebody in prison, you're paying a lot of money for this. This country spends a huge amount of money on law enforcement, and it's like a black box. Taxpayers have no idea what they're getting for their money, and the answer is generally nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing or the biggest horror you can think about.
It's well, right, actually... but I mean, we're not. But forget the human rights problems. We're right, not safer. Right. This right. mass incarceration thing we have is not making people safer. Mm-hmm. And people don't understand that because they're not given the access to the information as to what's going on in our prison and how prisons are destroying communities on the outside and are destroying people on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's something actually I wanted to get into because you do point out the irony that Heather's book, which, you know, again, it's just if people don't have the book, you need to get it. All right. It's really a tremendously important book. And to read these days because it has so much to do, not the historically alone with what happened, understanding what happened with Attica, but actually what that all means, what bearing it has on the world today. And, you know, Alan, one of the things you point out is the irony that Heather's book, that there was this mass incarceration that, you know, she talks about that was built on prison officials' false narrative about the Attica Rebellion, and that the book itself contains the perfect reason why censorship in prisons cannot be allowed.
That's right. No question about it. And, you know, I mean, and it was very specific the way they built that narrative. And she describes a specific meeting in Governor Rockefeller's pool house of all the players that are involved, from the state police to the corrections people, the prosecutors, and the governor's staff and corrections officials all came together within days of the takeover and agreed on what we're going to say. What are we going to tell the public is happening here? And some of that obviously happened beforehand because they put out this, you know, before the actual takeover happened, before we had any evidence at all, they released to the press. They had a big press conference saying that guards' throats had been slit and at least one guard had been emasculated, and that's why they had to go in with force because they had to save the lives of the rest of the hostages, all of which was a total and complete lie. Heather then goes through in great detail the next 10 years that they spent trying to justify that lie, and that went everywhere from state police officers going out to funeral homes to try to get funeral directors to sign affidavits saying that there was in fact a slit throat on this body, intimidating coroners who were doing the formal autopsies, burying reports, ensuring that the only people who got prosecuted for this were prisoners. So it went on for a decade trying to support this complete lie that was put out at the beginning. And that was really a intentional thing, which went all the way to the White House. And that's the other thing she does a really good job of documenting. This is not just something that happened on the state level. This was national policy. You know, Nixon was crazy and taped all of his conversations. So we now actually have the communications between Rockefeller and Nixon. And Nixon says very specifically, he says, was this the black people? And Rockefeller says, yes, we can blame this on the black rebels. And Nixon says, okay, then you're not going to have a problem. I mean, so this was orchestrated as high as you can get in our government.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have two more questions for you, and one will be easy, so I'll save that for the end. But this other one just comes right off of what you've just been saying, where you recently wrote, and I think it was in a review you did of Heather's book, and you recently wrote that you felt for years that a huge mistake was made in this country in the early 70s. And I think that's what you're getting at now, and that a consensus developed that prisoners were bad people and prisons needed to be tougher and more bad people needed to be locked up. And all that led to more and more oppressive prisons culminating in supermax prisons. Now you say that this was not a mistake, that the government intentionally set this up this way. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So, I mean, the narrative, starting about the time of Attica, we discovered that we could use solitary confinement in this society in order to bury people even further away who were already in prison. We also discovered that an easy way to solve, in big quotes, many of our social problems was to hide them behind prison walls. So rather than dealing with questions like income inequality, rather than dealing with questions like hunger, rather than dealing with questions like the fact that people were coming back from Vietnam so screwed up that they couldn't hold a job, rather than actually solving those problems, we simply criminalized. We criminalized homelessness. We criminalized drug addiction. We criminalized the sort of actions that some veterans took when they came back here suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder. We criminalized it and then locked those people away, and then we could pretend the problem didn't exist. Within the prison system then, we said, okay, we have really bad people we've put in prison here. All these people are criminals. They're not just products of our society, but they're criminals, so it's okay to lock them away. So when they misbehave in prison, we can say the same thing. We can say, see, they're really, really bad people, so we have to lock them away in solitary. And then when they still misbehave in solitary, because, of course, solitary makes all of those problems that people have worse, then they say, well, we need a supermax prison so they can't actually ever communicate with anybody. We'll really isolate them. And that's what we did. We made it more and more difficult to see the problem rather than solving the problem. And I don't know how to say this other than that none of that was a mistake. It was not just that people didn't understand human nature. It was a specific, politically driven decision that we would not spend the money that we needed to spend, not spend the resources to actually solve any of these problems, but rather we would hide them away.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me end with this. You actually, tell us where things stand now. I mean, because a lot of people, you know, I know a lot of people that went and got Heather's book and were just really moved by it. And, you know, and that's all over the country. People were writing to me and telling me how much they liked it and friends got it and they liked it. But there's a lot that people have to learn. But there's also with this effort to suppress this, where do things stand now?
Well, the case is brand new. As you said, we just filed it. So nothing has happened in our case yet. But what I would urge people to do who are not in Illinois is when you read a copy of the book and you like it, great, but buy a copy and send it to a prisoner. This book should be in every prison in the country. So it's now out in paperback, which is one of the reasons we waited, because many prisons have rules against hardback books. It's now out in paperback. It also means it's cheaper. Buy a second copy and send it to a prisoner. Prisoners need to read this book. Obviously, you should buy it yourself and read it yourself, but also send one inside. I just think that it's crucial that the prison system be flooded with copies of Heather's book so that let's force their hands nationwide. Every state should have to have a policy whether they're going to let this book in, and if they're not, then we need to bring them all to court and challenge that in the court.
And this is a time, and this is a book that really can make a difference in all those people's lives and in society
right.
at large. So.
And if people are, and a lot of people saw the national strike that just went on and said, how can I support them? What can I do? This is one of the many things you can do in order to support the people on the inside.
Mm-hmm. All right, Alan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and stay in touch, man, and keep us informed about what's going on with your efforts there. Okay?
Absolutely. As soon as we get any readback, we will let you know.
All right, Alan. Thanks a lot now.
Bye.
Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Alan Mills. Alan is executive director of Uptown People's Law Center, where he's worked for 35 years fighting for justice for prisoners, tenants, and disabled people in Illinois. And the Uptown People's Law Center has 9 class action lawsuits pending against the Illinois Department of Corrections. And he has been leading a fight. He has been one of the people leading a fight around the attempt to get rid of, to keep the book Blood in the Water, the Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and its legacy out of the prisons in Illinois and by extension all over the country. All right. Okay, I'm going to give you a chance to hear the trailer from a new speech by Bob Avakian, why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. There are going to be special preview showings of this film around the country in the next week or so, so you can find out about them at revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us. And on October 19th, the film will premiere on the internet. And take it from me, there has never been a speech like this on these questions until now. So check out the trailer and I'll have more to say afterwards.
Why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution.
A speech by Bob Avakian, now on film. There has never been a speech like this on these questions until now.
How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people. White supremacy, male supremacy, wars of empire, the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants, the destruction of the planet. Why is this the state of humanity?
If you agonize over this question but don't know the answer, or what we need to do about it,
there is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same, or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. An actual revolution does not mean trying to make some changes within this system. It means overthrowing this system and bringing into being a radically different and far better system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world, and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity. Let's be honest. This is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible. If we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk.
At this moment, this speech from Bob Avakian, the leader of the revolution, needs to be seen by you. By everyone who yearns for a radically different world and a better future.
Revolution is possible, and we have to go to work to make it real.
Premiering online at revcom.us, October 19th, 2018. For more information on the film and Bob Avakian, go to revcom.us and the Bob Avakian Institute.org. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, with the trailer from Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. It's a film of a speech given earlier this year. This trailer is now available online along with other materials. If you have agonized about the horrors of this society but didn't know why we face all this and thought that there was no way out, this filmed speech will reveal why those outrages go on and how they can be changed.
If you go around talking about it and you're feeling and you're really deeply feeling the need to change the world, to get out from under all this hell, then you need to hear this. There has, as it was said, there has never been a speech like this. There has never been anything like this in this country. And people who care about humanity here and around the world need to hear it.
And you need to be part of making it available to everyone. As I said, the trailer is online along with other materials. There's a targeted social media advertising campaign going on focused on reaching college students. And there are many other ways to get involved to make the October 19th premiere a success and to put revolution on the map.
Okay, now one of the things is that earlier on, a few weeks ago, we ran a piece by Bob Avakian. We ran it's a musical piece, and it's a, well, I'll let you hear it. A lot of you already heard it, but a lot of people wrote to me and said that they wanted to hear it again. They wanted to get more. They wanted to know where they could get it, all this other stuff. So I'd really like you to take a listen to this, okay? It's Bob Avakian, and it's basically, well, check this out, and we'll talk about it after it's over, okay? So check this out now.
All played out. We must broadly unite to carry out the fight to resist the crimes of this system. But on the real, revolution is the only solution. So we need to call out things whose time has run out, which keep people in chains, suffering unbearable pain. These things are all played out. Capitalist vultures, big time and worldwide exploiters, preaching about personal responsibility, ranting about predators and criminality, terrorizing the youth in the inner cities, while you loot everywhere you see, slaughter people and rain destruction through crimes untold, all to enforce your rule and amass your gold on the backs of billions, chaining them in slavery new and old. Your time in history, it's gone. It's all played out. This puffed up stuff about the land of the free and the home of the brave, a country that built itself on bodies of slaves and ruthless genocidal robbery, that spreads its empire through plunder, driving countless people under with its bloody red, white, and blue rag unfurled. All this pompous nonsense about the leader of the free world, that's all played out. Vicious politicians and mindless mobs, screaming and threatening, hounding people driven from their homelands, growling and howling, speak English, go home. These fools aren't saying anything worthwhile in any tongue. It's the same old song they've always sung. Fade deeper in the shadows, suffer in silence while you slave to create wealth we crave. It's our way, backed up by violence. This garbage is all played out. People of privilege demanding their right to be a parasite, whining about how things aren't good like they used to be back in the day when things were done in an even worse way. Look you in the face, say it's not about race or keeping half of humanity down, but want you in your place if you're a woman or black or brown. What this is, it's all played out. Nigger, a homicidal epithet from days of slave ship nightmare, plantation overseers with whips, lynch mobs, racist whites on power trips, repeated still now by far too many, openly racist or hyped as hip and cool, frat boys blasting rap. Who do they think they fool? Nigger, a word that bites deeper than a frothing rabid beast, that shouts the horror of centuries, cruelty and brutality, a word nobody should want to use, a word that just can't be made good, even if a shout out to homies in the hood. This word and everything it stands for, it's long past time it be all laid out. Modern day Uncle Toms, respectable Negroes who squawk out poison, parrot lies of powers that be, packaged slander is the truth, never fail to blame the youth, even slam them as our worst enemy. Oh, you bootlicking wannabe second class bourgeoisie, you're all played out. Reverends and the rest, not ones who really stand with the oppressed, but those who strut and preach to keep the people down on their knees, suffering indignities, who put the blame on those unfree for ways that they are kept in misery. Pompous, self-righteous asses who breathe contempt for the masses, fools who worship the powers that be, insisting that things stay locked within the bounds of bargains with the bourgeoisie. All played out. Backward-ass athletes and entertainers wearing a cross, slavish symbol of submission, never making it their mission to use their position to help people rise up, never raise a fist but point a foolish finger to the sky, giving praise, helping to spread the lie that in this system you can make it if you try. So if you're poor and beaten down, it's you to blame, never demanding to know why, if some supposed God controls all this, so many suffer needlessly. Shame should be on such a God if it existed, but all this God talk is just twisted. It's all in God's hands, leave it to the Lord, just help this system stay in power. When bowing down to lords and masters should be over, all this too is all played out. Falling for that game, caught up in those lies about Obama, how he's bringing peace and something really new, when he does the same as done before, still using
torture, no better than John Hugh and that whole crew, waging unjust wars that never cease. You look the other way, time after time, day after day, at all the crimes against humanity under Obama's command and with his decree. He talks about getting beyond race. His is just a different face that covers all too familiar murder and brutality by sneering pigs who hunt down youth in inner cities. You should know this game is all played out. Elections, where if you're looking for a better world, no matter how you choose, yes, BS, you lose. You're always left deflated and frustrated because the politicians and elections are cogs in a machine, part of a system that runs and rules by treating human beings and the earth as things to be exploited and despoiled. Believing the hype, putting all your faith in this bourgeois democracy, this lie of people's sovereignty, come on, it's all played out. Placing your hand over your heart, honoring the rag of U.S. imperialism, doing your part to prove you are respectable, will do only what's acceptable. Pledging allegiance to this flag, bowing down to this monstrosity that causes so much horror for humanity. All played out! I got my mind on my money and my money on my mind. That craziness about being like Scarface, acting without a trace of humanity, plundering and violating without remorse, killing and dying for no good purpose. Give it up, it's all laid out. Men thinking it's their right to order women around and misuse them, to degrade and abuse them, talking all that talk about bitches and hoes, and if she's pregnant she can't have an abortion because she should have kept her legs closed. Assertion of manhood, or talk of protecting womanhood, which still means keeping women subordinated and dominated. All this garbage about women being less than man, less than fully human, that's all laid out. Disrespecting people who love someone of the same sex, treating them as objects of contempt, dogging them, beating them down for being different. Religious tradition encoding oppression, authority invoked to enforce suppression of sexuality in forms that are outside the norms that are proclaimed natural and God-ordained. Norms that in reality enforce exploitation, perpetuate patriarchy and male domination. All this too is all laid out. Shop until you drop. Buy, buy, buy. You are what you own. Your worth is what you purchase. I. Throngs gathering to scramble for the latest iToy rage, but not to resist injustice and endless outrage. All played out! Tabloid addiction and gossip slinging, treating as prominent what is really trivial, making what really matters seem invisible, acting like mobs in Roman arenas, sneering and snarking with a vicious demeanor, building yourself up by tearing other people down. All laid out. Putting up with all this madness, even though you know it's wrong. Being passive, thinking how they want you thinking, acting just to get along, singing that old song, that though the crimes are terrible and massive, nothing can be done about this, nothing can change, because of human nature, things are bound to be this way. Revolution, that was tried and it failed. Communism, voice dissent and they'll haul you off to jail. With communism, they take away your freedom. We say that's just wrong. Plus there's a new synthesis. There are speeches, books with deep analysis. But you don't read them, won't hear them or go near them. You remain in paralysis. Like that, you're all laid out. A so-called left that to tell the truth finds it frightening and distasteful to change the world radically at its root. Disgraceful. A left that is content with posing, devoid of rage or joy, its passion spent. Deceiving mimic, miming what it claims to be opposing. Rejects the path of revolution. Insists there can be only one solution that is viable and desirable. the confines of this system. Change conforming to the dictates of this brutal order. Talks forever of democracy. Cover for dictatorship of bourgeoisie. Politics of identity that really comes back down to me. If it speaks of socialism, it is tired out, dried up dogma. No reality, lacking fire, ferment, and conviction. Impoverished imagination, lowered vision. The change it talks about is paltry fiction. Lifeless, desiccated, can't lead anyone to be emancipated. A left like that is
all the way out.
This whole damn system, root and source of all this madness.
All the way out.
Ruptured, advanced, beyond all that, no doubt. Putting an end to this insanity. Working for revolution to emancipate all humanity. That's what we got to be all about. All the rest opposes and opposes what cries out to be done. It needs to be over and gone. It's
all played out.
All right, welcome back. I was just tripping with that, all right? That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and musician and composer William Parker. And the piece is All Played Out. And if you're looking for All Played Out, you can find that at revcom.us on the Bob Avakian tab there. Or you can go to my Facebook page and find it. And I really recommend people go and find it. I know people, as I said, people were talking to me about how much they liked it. The man who delivers my mail stopped me and said how much he liked it and he wanted a copy of this. All right, so I think this is really an incredibly important piece that people should be digging into. Right now, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Will Frankum. Will is the co-director of a film called The Penalty, a new documentary that takes on the horror of the death penalty in the U.S. through the stories of three different people. And it's families, basically, that get involved in this. And it's really a very, very moving and enraging film. I watched it twice and I was really moved by it, but I was also very angry when you see the kinds of things that happen, but also inspired by the way that the people who have been impacted by this have, you know, were able to stand up and not build their own life, but actually work to actually make things different for people, you know, that have been impacted by this on a large scale in society. And I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Will Frankum. And Will, welcome.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Well, give people a sense of the film. What is it and what led you to make this film?
Yeah, so the film is essentially looking at the death penalty issue through a few different stories shot over essentially 4 years. So we started filming going on about 4.5 years ago. And it's through the eyes of one murder victim's family in Florida who are trying to decide whether or not they want the death penalty for their daughter's killer. One federal public defender in Ohio who's working to stop the use of new execution drugs in Ohio when the previous drugs that were used were stopped being used for executions. And then a guy who was innocent on death row in Louisiana for 17 years, and we follow him as he puts his life back together. And, you know, sort of what it's like to sort of move into the world after that amount of time in solitary confinement and facing the punishment of death. So, yeah, we tried to use these stories to sort of highlight, you know, where America is at currently in terms of capital punishment. And, you know, through these sort of human stories, give us sort of wider perspective, but, you know, while following sort of who we consider to be some fantastic characters.
Mm-hmm. You know, somebody pointed this out to me, and I thought it was actually worth talking with you about, that, you know, there's a lot of people see the death penalty. Well, they see a certain capriciousness of the death penalty, that it's imposed in a handful of states, in a handful of counties in those states, and to a handful of people. Let's talk about that, because the reality of that, that's on the one hand, that there's elements of that that are true, but then there's also the very horrifying reality that the death penalty still very much is enforced and is, you know, like I think you've mentioned it, that it's actually possible that someplace like California might even be end up being the king of the death penalty world.
Yeah, we have, I mean, It is true that it is in some ways quite fringe, in that it is very it's hyper localized. You know, it's enforced in only a handful of counties across the country, usually ones that can afford to actually pursue it because it's very expensive. And you know, in a handful of districts where you have district attorney's offices and prosecutors that are willing to really push for it, and often that plays into the politics of the area and the politics of campaigns. But you're right to say that it is really happening, and it is a threat. You know, I mean, I would say that, you know, we've had the film on tour in California all week, and it's been great to show it here and to highlight for people that, you know, you know, in this state there is the biggest death row population in the whole of America by a long way. You've had two recent, you know, attempts to sort of abolish the death penalty that didn't fail. They came very, very close, but didn't pass, sorry. And then one vote to speed it up, essentially, is what they're going to hope to do. I don't know if they'll actually achieve it. And that did pass. So there is a very real threat that California will be, you know, trying to execute people again very soon. And at quite a pace, if they achieve what they say they're hoping to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's you know, one of the things that really got to me too was that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, okay, you know, there's this argument that gets raised about, you know, that what we were just talking about, but then there's also the part of the terror that's concentrated in the death penalty is the fact that it's always there. You know, it's always there. And even if it's in, you know, other states, when not, people are aware of this and they're hit hard in it they're hit hard by it in different ways. The people facing the execution and then their families and then the people like the lawyer that has to go through this all with people and fight very bravely to stop this. But all of these people that you brought up are actually really, really brave and determined to stand up, not just for themselves, but to basically to take on and push back this crime against humanity.
Yeah. We absolutely felt that when we were trying to make this film, you know, this is actually my third project on the death penalty. I made one about a single case, a guy, Mumia Abujamon, in Philadelphia. Then we did a series about looking at, you know, different cases of people who've been innocent on death row and how they ended up there. And this, I think, was a totally, you know, when we approached this, our producer Laura kept talking about how, you know, we really, you know, we wanted to look at the tentacles of the death penalty and how it reached in so much further than just that person that sits on death row. And I think that, you know, we wanted to make a film that, although it's about the death penalty, never actually goes on death row. You know, that the cameras will never be on the prison walls. It's always something that is taking place in so-called normal life outside of the prison. And we really were keen to try and show that, you know, that it affects much more than just that person on death row, whether it's, you know, what is it like to be the child of a federal, you know, of a defense attorney whose parent has to, you know, shoulder the burden of having to deal with this all the time? Or what is it like to be the brother or sister of a murder victim's family being dragged back into court all the time? Or, you know, the girlfriend of a guy who is, you know, has the trauma of facing an impending death sentence for 15 years. So it really is. We started to think of it more as like a public health crisis. One of our executive producers kept talking about that. And I think that I hope that we've achieved in showing a sort of slightly different view of the death penalty than maybe has been shown in films before, that, you know, it does reach and bleeds out to the much wider society than just that in prison. And obviously, our film only looks at three stories. There's much more to that. You know, what is it like for the wardens who have to work with these prisoners day in, day out? What is it like for the prison guards who have to who do have relationships with these people who then they have to play a part in their death? You know, what is it like for the children of executed inmates? You know, we heard stories just while we were making the film of people, you know, who had to take their children to see their parents, essentially, or for a final visit with their parents, knowing that was going to be the last time they see them alive. And I think that is a barbaric thing that we don't really consider often when we're looking at capital punishment. And those are innocent people. You know, they haven't done anything wrong. And to think that we are putting people through that, I think is something that really should be thought about more than, you know, just the sort of traditional narrative that surrounds the death penalty in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. You know what? That really reminds me of this, the part, and it runs through the film, but the part Ned that talks about that shows in each different way, and in particular with the family who's the mother and the two children and their adult children, basically, or teenage children, and their sister that was killed. You know, but it happens with the lawyer as well, that each of them has to face the fact that they're going up against a system that is marked by inhumanity, by stealing, by robbing the humanity by attempting to rob the humanity out of people themselves. And each one of them actually comes to the conclusion that there's ways that they cannot accept that. And I thought that was really, you know, because somebody could look at that and say, oh, well, he must have staged that. But actually, when you watch the thing, these people, all in their own ways, the lawyer, the family that lost their sister and their daughter, and then the guy that was held for 15 years and was held there and still is looked at with suspicion, even though he was proven to be completely innocent, you know. And all of these things actually said something about the fight to actually present these people, and I think you do a really good job of this, present these people in all of their humanity in this film, from the things that, you know, the family that started out really hating it and wanting the death penalty to actually coming together and saying, we don't want this guy killed. You know, it's a very, very moving film in that way.
Thank you so much. I mean, we've got very lucky, I think, in the sense that we started off making quite a different film. There was lots of expert interviews and, you know, sort of talking heads, and we wanted to reveal facts and figures and sort of do a more sort of traditional documentary. And I think that what happened was, as the editing process went on, well, and as the filming process went on, we realized that we had some extraordinary stories were emerging in front of us. You know, that obviously what the without giving out too much information, but, you know, the execution doesn't go as planned for the state. So Alan gets thrust into a fight, and Darlene suddenly finds, who is the mother of Shelby, who was murdered, finds herself changing her mind, and then right at the center of a political fight. And I think that what we really found was we had these three characters who really refused to not fight. You know, they're all fighters, and I think that was what really makes the film, you know, gives it a drama that we hope carries the stories forward, and I think makes it more watchable than if we'd have just sort of been doing more, you know, sort of sit down interviews and things, which we did do. But I think during the editing process, they got cut down more and more and more until they just weren't there at all, because these stories demanded the screen time that we finally give them in the piece. Because I think we are very lucky to have just been blessed with three extraordinary characters who are also stuck within extraordinary circumstances, and those stories play out in extraordinary ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, we just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this. Tell our listeners why they really should, not just should, but need to see this film.
I think that, you know, I mean, like I said, this is my third film on the death penalty. I think that they all have their strengths, but this is, I think, the first time that we really have been able to show, you know, the sort of drama inherent within just the process of, you know, what it takes to even get to trial in a death penalty case, you know, how we actually push that forward in terms of, you know, what it takes to actually execute someone in terms of the process of that. And also, you know, the collateral damage, whether it's, you know, the families or lawyers or whatever, and all these people that are involved in the process. And I think that, you know, there have been many, many good films on the death penalty, you know, but I think that maybe this has a slightly different thing to say if people have seen those other ones. So we really hope that we will have, you know, we're currently screening in San Diego. Hopefully people will be able to see on a streaming platform soon.
Okay, well, definitely let us know when that happens so we can tell people, because I think there's going to be a lot of people that don't just want to see this film but need to see it. I think it's extremely important.
Well, just a shameless plug there is if people like our Facebook page or go to thepenaltyfilm.com, they can sign up for a newsletter, and we send out information of any details, any updates will all be sent out via there, and we'll also obviously let you know as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, tell people again, where do they have to go to get that?
Go to www.thepenaltyfilm.com, and then you can link to that. Goes to our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and there's also a sign up there for the newsletter.
And I was just informed that we will be linking it to my Facebook page as well.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you so much.
Sure. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. And stay in touch, man. All right?
Cheers. Thank you.
Okay,
take
you
care.
You too. Bye now. Bye. All right, we got real quick. We just got to run through some things right now. I want to thank everybody that was part of the show today. I'd like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Jimi Hendrix and All Along the Watchtower. Talk to you again next week.
There must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine, plowman dig my earth. None will ever own the mine, nobody of it is worth. But a joke, but you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us start talking falsely now. The hour's getting